We tend to picture medical breakthroughs as sudden, cinematic moments. But in the world of pediatric surgery, change often arrives differently. It's quieter, slower, and often invisible. It's about knowing where to look and staying with a question for years, even decades. Today, we are bringing you three articles from the pages of the Journal of Pediatric Surgery, and from the minds of surgeons who don't just want to fix problems, they want to understand them. Welcome to the Journal of Pediatric Surgery Article Review Podcast. I'm your host, M. Godey from Cincinnati Children's. Today, we have three publications from the first quarter of 2025, January, February, and March issues. In this episode, we will talk about how we can use remote ischemic conditioning for preventing necrotizing enterocolitis and the evolving story of pain control after NASP procedures for pectus excavatum. And lastly, the nuances of bladder augmentation. As always, please check the link in the description below to read each paper. If you're ready, let's start with our first article. It's titled, Remote Ischemic Conditioning Decreases the Incidence and Severity of Necrotizing Enterocolitis, or NEC, or NEC, as you will hear throughout the podcast. Validation in a Large Animal Model, from JPS January 2025 issue. And Dr. Ignacio chose this article for us to highlight.
My name is Romeo Ignacio. I am the Section Chief of Pediatric Surgery at Rady Children's Health. I also serve as a clinical professor at the University of California, San Diego.
He was also the former chair of APSA Publications Committee.
This article was quite high quality animal study and actually provides some insights and, more importantly, a potential therapeutic option for NEC.
We also talked to the senior author of this paper.
My name is Oluyinka Olutoye. I'm a pediatric surgeon at Nationwide Children's Hospital, where I have the pleasure of serving as a surgeon-in-chief, and I also run a research laboratory in the Center for Regenerative Medicine.
In his laboratory, they've been working on trying to understand factors to help them diagnose necrotizing enterocolitis early so they can have means of being able to treat it better.
They picked a piglet model for necrotizing enterocolitis. They used an animal study that's been established that they can look and evaluate and answer questions in relation to the pathophysiology and potential therapeutic options for necrotizing enterocolitis.
This is where it gets interesting, because unlike the rodent models, which are more of an induced model, the piglet model is almost a spontaneous one for NEC. After these animals delivered prematurely and they're fed, they will never know which one will develop NEC, just like typically happens with neonates.
And being a large animal model, we can actually monitor them more actively and intensively with pulse oximetry and near infrared spectroscopy and Fuchsenbrod sampling. So it's a robust model to actually study necrotizing enterocolitis.
The innovation they're exploring sounds almost paradoxical. What if we help the gut survive trauma by inflicting tiny traumas ahead of time?
They did remote ischemic conditioning, basically put a small tourniquet in one of the limbs and compressed that, caused a limb occlusion of not the gut, but just the limb.
As we know, necrotizing enterocolitis primarily affects premature infants. It's believed that introducing substrates like formula to the immature gut can trigger ischemia. It might sound counterintuitive, but the body's response to minor injury can prime it to resist major damage later.
By giving a little dose of ischemia, it allows those cells to say, okay, this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to prepare for the next insult.
They then evaluated the incidence and severity of necrotizing enterocolitis across three groups by inducing limb occlusion at different intervals, once every 12 hours for the high-frequency group, once every 24 hours for the low-frequency group, and no occlusion for the control group.
And the idea behind that is by inducing ischemia at the microscopic level or from the intestinal perfusion level, it's actually conditioning it to withstand such ischemic results.
Now, of course, the exact role is not fully understood, but it looks obviously that by some local stimulation, there's systemic effects that are elicited that now have impact further distant from that limb where the ischemic reperfusion is being induced.
The whole field of remote ischemic conditioning is actually pretty intriguing. So it's been used for different organ systems and different areas, but its application to necrotizing enterocolitis is the novel thing here.
And so after they did the limb ischemia and inducing necrotizing enterocolitis, they did postmortem studies. They looked at the anatomical, the histologic evaluations to confirm the presence of necrotizing enterocolitis.
Interestingly, in the rodent model, both low and high frequency remote ischemic conditioning reduced the incidence of necrotizing enterocolitis overall. However, only the high frequency intervention was effective in decreasing the severity of the disease in piglet models.
So there may be some dose response, and that necessarily the dose given in rodents may not be applicable to piglets, and that therefore raised the concern as to what would the appropriate dose be in humans.
There are also broader considerations. Necrotizing enterocolitis remains a significant financial burden on the healthcare system. Over the years, neonatal care have improved survival rates for preterm infants. The number of babies at risk for complications like necrotizing enterocolitis has also increased.
And yet, in spite of 40, 60, 70 years of managing NEC, we still are not very good in terms of early diagnosis and being able to prevent or treat NEC in such a way to significantly affect its outcomes.
When we look at the mortality rate for necrotizing enterocolitis in very low birth weight infants, it really hasn't changed. That mortality rate is as high as 30%. And although surgeons operate on it, we only take care of the complications.
I think not only do we want to try and figure out what the optimum dose is, but even also to better understand the mechanism by which this works. Because I think the more knowledge we have about how this is effective, the better we can fine-tune it.
So imagine a way that you can therapeutically, in the early stages of NEC, decrease not only the incidence, but the severity. I think the impact is not only financially great, but clinically great. And so we can actually move the needle and improve the mortality rate for these children. So I think that's the exciting part of it.
So the quest continues. Finding the right frequency, minimizing harm, and just maybe preventing necrotizing enterocolitis before it ever begins. That was a very inspiring article. Let's move to the next one. 6 years of quality improvement in pectus excavatum repair, implementation of intercostal nerve cryoablation, and ERAS protocols for patients undergoing NUS procedure. First, we will hear from the JPS editor who selected this article for us to highlight.
I'm Dr. Patrick Jung, and I'm a pediatric surgeon from Hong Kong, currently working in a Queen Mary Hospital and the University of Hong Kong.
He is also chairman of the publication committees of the Pacific Association of Pediatric Surgeons, or PAPS. We also talked to the first author.
I'm Jordan Rook. I'm a general surgery resident at UCLA, planning on a career in pediatric surgery.
And the senior author of this paper.
I'm Howard Jen. I'm one of the pediatric surgeons at Mental Choice at UCLA.
Since I started working on this podcast about 3.5 years ago, we've seen a growing use of nerve cryoablation in NUS procedures, particularly in pectus excavatum cases. While the technique has gained a lot of support, some still question its long-term effects, given that it is relatively new. And the authors conducted a 6-year quality improvement study, and they shared with us how it started and what motivated them to focus on this topic.
Medicine is a very iterative process. People keep on improving, keep on finding ways to better their care. ERAS protocol may not by itself prove to be significant statistically, but overall you can see a better picture of the gradual improvement. And I think that's what we wanted to highlight with the purpose of the study.
This was a retrospective review of the sequential implementation of 2 protocols at UCLA for patients undergoing the NUS procedure for pectus excavatum. First, a cryoablation protocol, followed by a cryo plus ERAS enhanced recovery after surgery protocol.
We took a look at all patients from 2017 to 2023.
They then separated patients into three treatment categories based on the date during which they were treated.
There was a group treated with only epidurals prior to 2019, only cryoablation from 2019 to 2021, and a cryoablation with an ERAS protocol after 2021.
The ERAS protocol included preoperative counseling on pain management, multimodal analgesia, including intraoperative methadone, and early ambulation discharge.
We assessed the outcomes of length of stay, inpatient morphine milligram equivalents, that's opioid exposures, and discharge opioids.
We learned that in quality improvement studies, it's really important to assess unintended consequences of any interventions.
So we also assessed what we call balancing measures, which included operative time, pain scores, and operative complications.
After analysis, the paper found that this improvement in the length of stay, postoperative pain control, and the use of analgesics was the most significant improvement in the most recently operated group receiving cryoablations and also ERAS protocol.
There was a 96% drop in postoperative opioids. Their length of stay dropped from 5 days to average 1.5 days.
There was a slight bump in our operative times, which are expected when you're doing cryoablation on a bunch of intercostal nerves.
They also saw a small jump in postoperative day one pain scores. And how did they interpret that finding?
That's the point at which we implemented the ERAS protocol as this kind of continuous quality improvement effort.
And once they implemented the ERAS protocol, they saw those pain scores drop back down to the pre-cryoablation levels.
When you are doing the cryoablations, you're also using some intercostal blocks, and local anesthesia probably lasts about 4 to 6 hours, and they do wear off, and then they take time for the cryoablation to take an effect.
So there's a little gap in the analgesia there. That's why they've seen this bump in the opioid use.
But with the longer dose of intraoperative methadone, I think that was the biggest surprise of our study, given the lasting effect until the cryoablation works.
Methadone is a long-acting opioid. Its half-life is between 24 and 36 hours.
And so we gave patients, while they were asleep, a 0.1 mg per kg dose, up to 5 milligrams, with the expectation that while they were getting a decent amount of opioids intraoperatively, they would get a nice, smooth opioid analgesic effect during that postoperative day.
Dr. Jen mentioned that initially there was some hesitancy from anesthesiologists when it came to adopting intraoperative methadone use.
At the time we wrote this study, there wasn't another study that had included methadone as a component of a cryoablation ERAS kind of package. That was definitely one of the more innovative quality improvement measures that we included in this protocol.
Within our hospital, we are doing more liberal use of methadone, and we are trying to find other venues where the intraoperative of methadone can be used to decrease postoperative opioid use.
I do hope this paper can set examples that NOVOT and also descriptions of new technologies will be of high priority in the publication process.
We made some progress. We saw a few things we still needed to improve upon, and then we implemented something else to address that as this kind of continuous quality improvement effort. And I think that's honestly the biggest takeaway point.
And now we move across the Atlantic to Birmingham, England, for our last paper of the day. Long-term survival of bladder augmentation is influenced by its shape and mucosal lining. To discuss this paper, we talked to the senior author.
Hi, my name is Liam McCarthy. I am a consultant, pediatric urologist and renal transplant surgeon, and I work in Birmingham Children's Hospital in the West Midlands in the UK.
We will also hear from Dr. Mark Davenport, UK editor of the Journal of Pediatric Surgery, who chose this article for us.
Birmingham is the second biggest city in the whole of the UK. And as a consequence, this is a very busy children's hospital. And this, I think, is the key point about this series, its size. Patients treated between 2005 and 2022, and there are 168.
There were three techniques that were studied, two enterocystoplasty and one ureterocystoplasty.
We had a natural experiment going on because my senior colleague was doing augmentation using bowel patches one way. I did it another way, but we both did the urethral cystoplasties the same way.
Let's review these three techniques in detail.
First one was a simple patch placement derived from the ileum and implanted onto the dome of the bladder. There were 72 in this group.
Bowel pap got the wrong lining because it's absorptive, it makes mucus, it's associated with stones, and potential for malignancy long term.
And you got that irregular form because the length is bigger than the length of the cut in the bladder.
There was a similar number in the other form of enterocystoplasty in which the segment of ileum was refashioned to form an ileal cup, and that was implanted upon the dome of the bladder.
So you've got then the wrong mucosa, but with the right shape, which will hopefully fill and drain more regularly.
The third technique involved using a redundant megaureter, presumably because of a non-functioning kidney, and leaving it on its blood supply that was opened out and also inserted into the dome of the bladder.
Third group is the right lining, so you don't get mucus, you don't get absorption, you don't get anything like the same frequency of the stones.
But in order to keep the patch alive, you end up with a little T-cap handle at the bottom of the ureter to maintain its blood supply. Potentially could be associated with infection because of that.
Initially, they looked at their revision rate.
And in the simple patch enterocystoplasty and the urethrocystoplasty, that was very similar at about 11 or 12%. The exception was the ileal cup enterocystoplasty, in which there were no episodes of revision that were needed.
The next thing they looked at was the formation of stones, both in the upper urinary tract and also in the bladder itself.
In all of the bowel patches, you get absorption, so you get a circulation between the kidneys and the bladder. You get some acidosis, and you can get kidney stones and bladder stones.
Now, the kidney stones are because of the reabsorption, which shouldn't really be any different between the two groups, and indeed it wasn't.
But the bladder stones are much more likely to be associated with an irregular bladder and stasis.
In their analysis, the authors used two principles which hold in terms of the long-term success of a bladder reconstruction. First, what the nature of the mucosa is.
So those such as the simple patch enterocystoplasty and the ileal cup enterocystoplasty do have the wrong mucosa, and because they do tend to continue to secrete mucus into the bladder itself, that may be the reason for continued production of bladder stones.
Another important principle is the shape and configuration of the bladder itself. Patients with very irregular bladder shapes, and presumably with poorer function, are often those who received a simple patch repair.
So our hypothesis was that an irregular bladder and the wrong mucosa would mean that you had stasis, mucus, infection, which wasn't draining when you fill and empty the bladder. You get bladder stones, and then fibrosis, which might well then lead to further stasis, mucus, infections in a vicious circle.
And let's look at the 10-year survival.
By doing the origami, making a nice regular shape, they all survived. By doing the urethrocystoplasty, which has got the right lining but an irregular shape.
In these cases, patch failure occurred entirely within the first 5 years. Beyond that, up to about 12 years of follow-up, there were no additional patch losses observed.
So it was an early problem, not a progressive problem. And that fits with the criticism of the technique being a problem with the blood supply, as we've alluded to in the diagrams and the discussion in the paper.
But the simple patch results were quite different. The 5-year survival was 96%, so it was a bit better. But the failure was progressive, and by 10 years, it was a 25% failure rate.
So they conclude that the best overall appears to be those where you can do a urethrocystoplasty, but they do make the point that this is only possible in very selected cases. But if there was a choice for an enterocystoplasty, then it probably should be that of an ileal cup enterocystoplasty.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. We covered some exciting and meaningful research. First, we looked at how remote ischemic conditioning could become a powerful, non-invasive tool to lower the risk and severity of necrotizing enterocolitis in preterm infants. Then, we explored a 6-year quality improvement study showing that pairing cryoablation with ERAS protocol can can significantly reduce opioid use and hospital stays in patients undergoing NUS procedure. Finally, we discussed how the long-term success of bladder augmentation depends not just on the graft itself, but also on its shape and mucosal lining, reminding us how much surgical technique truly matters in pediatric urology. Thanks for joining us. We hope you liked this episode. Please follow Sacred MD on social media, give us a rating, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And don't forget to download the Stay Current app on the App Store and Play Store for tons of content.
GlobalCast MD, along with Cincinnati Children's Hospital, sharing knowledge to improve child health around the globe.